Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR and at WKAR.org. We should also mention that later this hour we visit the Carillon at Beaumont Tower at Michigan State University. It's not really summer without a visit to Beaumont. While the Carillonneur Ray McClellan is playing, that is a gorgeous sound that I associate with summer, midsummer, right? Ray McClellan visited with WKAR's Kevin Lavery, and we visit a beautiful garden comprised largely of native Michigan plants in Detroit, the city of Detroit. So we've got a very summery show here for you today. At the top, Michigan residents are wary of government at all levels, but have more trust in local elected officials than those at the state and federal levels. That's one of several interesting findings in the latest installment of Michigan State University's State of the State survey. The new poll, overseen by one of our next guests, shows the percentage of state residents who trust local government most of the time exceeds the percentage who trust state and federal government by a more than 2-to-1 margin. Now, to go over more findings and to explore what they might mean, we're joined by Dr. Charles Ballard, director of the State of the State Survey. Charlie, hi.
Hi.
And by a University of Michigan colleague, Tom Ivacco. Tom is the director of a related survey, part of U of M's Michigan Public Policy Survey, which makes for some interesting comparisons. Tom, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
Charlie Ballard, give us the basic framework of your survey. What were you trying to learn and from whom?
We ask a sample of about 1,000 Michigan adults, so it's the whole Michigan public, and we ask this once a year. We have a survey 4 times a year, but once a year we ask these questions about trust in government. And we ask for federal, state, and local, how do you feel about trusting the government to do what's right? And it's not a focus group. We don't specify what's right, and so people can give a variety of answers. The categories that we give are trust them always or most of the time, or some of the time, or seldom or never. So what we found for the positive category, nearly always or most of the time, we found that 39% trusted the local government. That number is only 19% for state, and it's 15% for federal. And the ones who trust local government who give the high category, the almost always or most of the time, they outnumber the ones who give the low category, seldom or never, for the local. But for state and federal, more people give the category than the thumbs up category.
Well, 39% is still not really that impressive of a number necessarily, even for the local, and they end up looking pretty good.
It's not a fabulous trust. Then there's another 40% who say some of the time, the bland middle-of-the-road category. So local looks kind of so-so. State looks worse than that, and federal looks a little bit worse than that. And so we see generally a sort of a wariness of government, but less mistrust in the local government. And that makes sense. The local government, you know, the city council or the township supervisor is somebody you know, whereas state government, that's often far away Lansing, and then federal government is often even farther away Washington, D.C.
So familiarity doesn't always breed contempt.
Not always.
Sometimes it's an advantage, is what it seems to show. Tom Ivacco, please explain to our listeners how your work figures into this.
At the University of Michigan, the Ford School of Public Policy, we have been conducting a survey of Michigan's local government leaders. It's somewhat modeled on the State of the State survey, but rather than interviewing citizens, we're interviewing the local elected and appointed officials all over the state. We take a census-based approach, so we try to contact all 1,856 of these jurisdictions. So that's counties, cities, townships, and villages. And we try to get responses from both the chief elected official and the chief appointed official. So city mayors and city managers, county board chairs and executives, township supervisors, and so mm-hmm. on.
And one striking finding in your work is how much less trust local officials have in the federal government than the larger public.
Yeah, this, in my eyes, is pretty eye-opening. Only 6% of these local government leaders across Michigan say they trust the federal government nearly always or most of the time. So whereas the State of the State survey found 15% of citizens feel that way, only 6% of local government leaders feel that way.
That is a jaw-dropper.
Isn't it?
I think a lot of people. I mean, what's been the response to that when you share that data with people?
Well, this show, Current State, is the opening salvo in getting these numbers out.
Oh, okay.
So your listeners will you know give us the first indication.
So the public's trust is arguably low, but local government personnel even less.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And these folks, you know, deal with government quite a bit. They're in government, so they work with state and federal.
Exactly.
So, quite concerned.
What is that based upon exactly? Now, is it part of your mission to take something away from that, or who ends up interpreting? Is it the WAGs on the op-ed page or elected officials? How do you get response to that finding?
Our goal is to get these data. We ask a wide variety of policy issues, including these questions about trust in government. And the goal of this survey program, the Michigan Public Policy Survey, is to help inform policy discussions and debates all over all stakeholders. So we send these data back to state policymakers, back to all of our respondents in local governments across the state, work with the media, such as here on WKAR, to just try to inform debates, let people know exactly what their local government leaders think and feel about issues like this.
Charlie Ballard, the history of the State of the State survey also suggests a general distrust of government at all levels that really goes back some time. Give us some historical perspective.
Yeah, the State of the State survey was established in 1994, and 95 was the first year when we asked these questions about trust in government, and we've asked them almost every year since then. So we've got almost 20 years of data. For the trust in local government, the results have been pretty constant. There's a very, very slight downward trend, but it's pretty much quite similar now to what we had 10, 15, 20 years ago. But for state and federal, there is a very noticeable downward trend. For state especially. State, we used to have more people giving the thumbs up, the nearly always or most of the time, than the seldom or never. In other words, there used to be a positive feeling of trust toward the state government on net. Now that has reversed, and the reversal, the two kind of switched places back in 06, 07, 08.
What's in play there?
I think a big part of that, if you remember what was going on, those were years when there was a divided government in the state. You had a Democratic governor but a Republican-controlled legislature, and they couldn't get anything done. Remember the government shutdowns on a couple of occasions.
Sure.
I think that eroded the public trust. But then now we have unified government with Republican control of both sides, and it hasn't turned the numbers around. The state government still has much worse approval in terms of trust than it had 10 or 15 years ago. And then for the federal government, there was a big, big upsurge in trust right after 9/11. And that actually carried over to lots of things. George W. Bush had very, very high ratings for a while, but then that has eroded very, very substantially. And so the numbers for the federal government have really plummeted in the last 10 years.
I find that so interesting in a way. There appears to be this tendency to come to the government's defense in the wake of a catastrophe. And in the case of 9/11, on further reflection, the government might have been found to at least be somewhat culpable for the catastrophe, really, in a way, in terms of security or airport safety or that kind of thing. Is there there's a psychological dimension that seems to be in play here that leads people to circle the wagons,
yes,
so to speak, after a catastrophe?
Yeah, I think most people were willing to give the benefit of the doubt in terms of it's unfortunate that the tragedy happened and that it got past our security apparatus, but then the real emotional response was this feeling that we did a good job in responding.
Okay.
That the government responded quickly and did its best to clean up after the problem.
Charlie, what do you take away from Tom Ivacco's findings involving local officials? Minimal trust in federal government. Any comment on that?
Well, at least a part of that probably is partisanship. The local officials are much more likely to be Republican than the general public in our sample. After all, when you think about the folks in Tom's sample, a lot of them are township supervisors in rural areas, and so that's half of their survey is Republican, whereas only 21% of ours identify themselves as Republican. And so part of that is, you know, the federal government is currently headed by a Democrat. So I think that's at least a part of it. But I think there's probably more to it than that. I think there's local government officials have a deep distrust of federal government, partly because they perceive the federal government as having meddlesome regulations but not funding those mandates. That's a part of it.
Tom Ivacco, tell us a little more about your yearly routine. Charlie's in charge of four surveys a year. What's the typical survey year like for you at U of M?
We do two surveys per year, one in the spring and one in the fall. We've been doing this since 2009, so it's still relatively new on our end compared to the state of the state survey. Our spring survey every year is focused primarily on fiscal health issues, basic budget policy and operations. And so we're kind of building up a longitudinal tracking database on how local governments are responding to the fiscal crisis. The fall survey each year changes topic. So we've looked at questions of intergovernmental cooperation, sustainability and kind of green policies, use of data in government decision making. So the fall surveys change topic each year. The spring survey is kind of long-term tracking of fiscal health.
And what did you find last time around? When did you last release new data?
Well, so
today. What you're hearing today.
Yes, today.
Okay.
Data we're releasing today are the first data from our spring survey, which just ended in June of last month.
Tell us more about what you found.
Well, extreme distrust, I would say, of the federal government in Washington. At the same time, in regards to the state government in Lansing, what we found is 19% of Michigan's local government leaders say they trust the state government nearly always or most of the time, while 28% say seldom or almost never. So trust at the local level towards the state is kind of underwater as well. And it's fairly equivalent to the citizens' views on state government. But as Charlie pointed out, our survey is much more Republican, local leaders, compared to citizens.
How is that? 50% Republican?
That's
correct?
Right, yes. And that's because, so our sample is of the local governments. There are 1,856. 1,200 of those, 1,241, are townships. And most of those townships are relatively small,
okay,
out of state, and they tend to be more Republican than the large urban areas in the state. Now, at the same time, I think one thing that we've kind of found over time in doing these surveys is on many issues, kind of less of a partisan basis in local government than there is at the state level or the federal level. But it still certainly shows up in some of these findings, including these questions about trust in higher levels of government.
How closely do you guys watch national survey results? You're both in the survey business. I mean, how closely, Charlie, do you watch those?
Oh, sure. When a new national survey comes out, whether it's the Wall Street Journal, NBC News poll, or one of the many others, Gallup, the Pew Research outfit, I'm very interested in those because it's always interesting to see whether what we find for Michigan is similar to for the nation as a whole, and often it is.
Do you ever encounter contradictory data? Tom Evacco?
Well, we find some surprising findings that we didn't expect to find. So, for instance, on one of our previous surveys, we asked questions of local leaders about their views on the state's emergency manager law. And we kind of expected partisanship, whether the leader was Republican or Democrat, to be one of the most important factors in whether they support or oppose that law.
Okay.
And it turns out there was some role of partisanship, but much more than that was the issue of whether local governments were in fiscal distress. And in local governments that in Michigan that are under severe fiscal stress, local leaders were much more supportive of the emergency manager law than in places that are not under fiscal stress. And that crosses party lines. So Democratic local leaders in Michigan in cities that are in pretty bad shape are much more supportive of this emergency manager law.
Interesting. Tom Evacco is the director of the University of Michigan Michigan Public Policy Survey. He's been joined by Dr. Charles Ballard, director of the State of the State Survey, and he operates out of Michigan State University. Great to have both of you on the show.
Thanks very much, Mark.
It's Current State on WKAR. This week marks the 150th anniversary of the turning point of the American Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg. During this week in 1863, General Robert E. Lee's all-out attempt to invade the North was turned down by the Union's Army of the Potomac, led by General George Meade. The battle ended with more than 50,000 killed and wounded. Michigan men suffered 40% casualties. Gettysburg sent the South on the road to its 1865 surrender. This week, WKAR presents a three-part series remembering the Battle of Gettysburg and Michigan's role in the war between the states. Here in Part 2, WKAR's Peter Wharf joins MSU history professor Roger Rosentrater at the MSU Museum to view and discuss the exhibit Michigan in the Civil War. Roger and Peter begin their discussion at a few of the artifacts on display.
This is a doctor's kit. It's sort of a footlocker-sized box with a very intimidating-looking saw, some probes. Pretty major knives. And what else do we have in here?
Well, there are some probes. I do not have one of these in my collection, even though you can buy a reproduction kit if you really want to. But they do look pretty frightening, actually, when you think about it. And again, the amputations and the infection all being part of the process. There are some pretty frightening pictures after the war. The Surgeon General did a collection of the men who had recovered, survived, and exposing various limbs or what's left of them.
It says here, to treat a bullet wound, a doctor poked a finger into the wound searching for the bullet. If it was possible, he used these forceps here. These are about a foot long to reach in and try and pull it out.
Yeah, and just imagine, again, the and these hospitals that are set up are sometimes set up literally set up anywhere. You can use a barn. So right away you can imagine the type of germs that are in the barn. Then the doctor is never washing off his hands clearly or any of the tools he's using, and he's taking his finger and probing it into the wound. The odds that anybody survives sometimes are amazing.
We're looking at some of the items here at the exhibit Michigan in the Civil War, the 150th anniversary, with Professor Roger Rosentrater, history professor at Michigan State University. We're talking about fixing men on the battlefield. Here's an item here used for fixing clothing and personal possessions.
Yeah, Peter, this is a great item because they're called a housewife, and it's just a sewing kit. And at the outbreak of the war, again, the Army doesn't provide its soldiers like it does today. I mean, yeah, they'll give you a uniform and a gun and a pair of boots or whatever, but beyond that, you really had to provide for yourself. So lots of women on the home front took it upon themselves to create various items for the soldiers, towels, socks, shirts. There was something called a havelock, which if you can imagine was kind of they don't have one on display here, but it was a draping over your kepi, your hat, so that you didn't burn the back of your neck. Soldiers never used them, and that's why you don't see them in the pictures. As a matter of fact, they didn't know what to do with them, and they got them by the literally thousands, and they might use them as a nightcap, or they might clean their weapon with them or whatever. And many of them finally said, don't send us any more of those things because we don't need them. But this housewife, this sewing kit, is an exceptional item on display here. It's identified to a Michigan soldier, and it's even got his name in there. And again, he had to take care of himself. I mean, there isn't anybody on the battlefield, certainly, or anyone going to do his sewing. He's going to have to do his own sewing. He can't go home. He can't go to the tailor, obviously. And if he needs to fix something, here's the item he would use. It is very nice. I've seen several. I own several. This one is as nice as I've seen.
Going to another item of everyday life, this appears to be actual food for soldiers from the Civil War.
Well, it does appear that way. And again, hardtack was the, I don't know if it was popular necessarily is a good way to describe it, but it was available certainly to Northerners, and it was just a cracker made out of flour and water. This particular label says there's lard in it. I've made hardtack for my students, and that's only flour and water and a little bit of salt. I've never put any lard in anything. But these were fairly, yes, you can imagine the name hardtack, so they're hard, right? But they weren't impervious to bugs. And they were called worm castles, as the label explains. And what the soldiers would do is, I mean, again, you couldn't discard them if you were provided with them. You had to make do, and soldiers were always hungry. So one of the ways they would deal with the problem was they'd create their coffee, and again, they didn't go to Beaners or anything like that. You know, if they were lucky, and they were usually Northerners had coffee, they would take their beans, and they'd have some hot water, and they'd put the beans in the bottom of their cup. They've got a cup on display here. Some of the cups were much larger, but they would just kind of break up the beans and pour in the hot water, as it were. Then they would take the hardtack, which is, again, not impervious to the bugs that are out there, break it up, put the hardtack in the coffee. Now, where are the bugs going to go? Or they're going to seek to flee, they're going to come to the top, and then you use your spoon and you discard the bugs, and then you go on with your meal. So what sounds pretty appetizing, doesn't it?
Roger, what's amazing to me about this hardtack that is on display in the museum, if you can believe it, is it says this is actually still preserved from the Civil War, and it doesn't look too bad.
It doesn't. Matter of fact, I have bought it for my students. There is a Boston bakery that makes hardtack today than they did for the Union Army during the Civil War. And it looks pretty similar, to be honest with you. Well, I'd like to tell you that the Yankees won because of Michigan soldiers, but I guess that's an exaggeration. We sent 90,000 men to the war. That was 50% of our military-aged male population. As a lot of guys, right? And they fought in all the major campaigns and a lot of lesser campaigns as well. Again, there are plenty of stories of where Michigan men performed heroically, men and women, and that's something that I must confess we don't see here, but we should talk about at some point, is that the important role of Michigan women, because it sometimes, as is often the case, we think of war as being a male-oriented or male-only. Yes, the soldiers were largely male, but one of the best known, there were actually several women who served in the ranks from Michigan, on both sides. And some of the better known ones are from Michigan, as it turns out. But, you know, again, Michigan was a solid blue state, I guess I would say, right? It was a solid northern state. Its men went off and fought both in the Eastern Theater and the Western Theater of the War. They had served, you know, again, if we talk about generals, we certainly had our share. We had our Medal of Honor winners as well. Maybe we weren't any more unique than certain other states, but we certainly made a major contribution.
That's such a high percentage when you think about the time in history, and then you think about states like New York and Pennsylvania, maybe others like New Jersey, with, I would think, much larger populations.
Yeah. There were larger populations, certainly, in those states, as you know. And one of the things that didn't happen here is that almost everybody from Michigan that served in the Union Army was a volunteer. Now, conscription was introduced in the war, and there were a few people from Michigan who were conscripted, but mostly it was volunteers, which, again, conscription was designed to try to encourage volunteering, and it worked. But in Michigan's case, most of these guys signed up, even well into the war, when they knew just how horrendous things were. And there are good stories about, I could think of two brothers, for example, from the Detroit area. The older brother went into the service, and then the younger brother wanted to follow, and the older brother said, hey, you don't know what you're missing. You know, just stay out. Well, as it turns out, the younger brother wasn't going to listen to the older brother, joined up, and the two brothers served in different units, and they both died at the Battle of Gettysburg. But again, that whole idea that even later in the war, you've still got plenty of men saying, it's my duty, my responsibility. And that may seem hokey today, or maybe to some they think, oh, that's not. But that really seems to be the attitude. I've got a set of letters from a Michigan woman whose husband went off and served 2 years, and then he was going to stay on. And long story short, he came home after his three-year enlistment. And even late in that particular period of time, and she'd already lost a brother to the war, she said, you know, we have to make this sacrifice. This union means that much, that we all, be it her at home with a young child or her husband in harm's way, we all have to make this sacrifice. So if she's representative, and I'd like to believe she is, these Northerners took it very seriously.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR and WKAR.org. On a block in Detroit's East English Village, Cheryl English's front yard sticks out like a green thumb. Her front yard, and for that matter her backyard, are masterpieces of gardening. Many of the plants she used to paint this picture are native to Michigan. She chose them not only because of their beauty, but because native plants are a crucial part of Michigan ecosystems and have many environmental benefits. Current State's Emmanuel Berry joined English Inner Garden, where she explained why people don't always appreciate native plants.
Our traditional garden choices are really driven by where we came from and not where we live. And by where we came from, I mean where the culture came from. And the culture basically came with, starting with Christopher Columbus in 1492, and what was the European invasion. And the European invasion included things like our livestock, our companion animals, our garden plants, our agricultural plants, our diseases, and just our cultural preconceptions of things, of how things should be. We came here to the Americas, and things were different. They weren't the way they were where we came from, and we set out to fix it because it wasn't right based on our experience and our context. And part of that had to do with the landscape, and the plants were not plants we recognized, and they interfered with what we were trying to do in terms of growing crops or what have you. What we have begun to learn recently, and it seems to be snowballing more and more, is that if we want to maintain the native populations of our songbirds, for example, or our pollinating insects like our monarch butterflies and our swallowtail butterflies, we need to have the native plants. And if we don't have them, we're going to lose that part of what we treasure here.
What are some of the other consequences of losing native plants, of not having native plants in gardens and spaces?
I don't know that we can even begin to understand what those consequences might be. I think about the first huge arboricultural disaster in the Americas, in North America, which was the chestnut blight coming in and devastating the American chestnut population. When Christopher Columbus landed in 1492, one out of every four trees in the eastern half of the U.S. was an American chestnut. And the chestnut blight wiped out 90% of them. We, in our ignorance, decided that the blight was going to kill every chestnut, so we clear-cut them out, not realizing that there might have been pockets of genetic resistance to this blight. And we have actually discovered remnant populations that have had a higher degree of resistance, and we are now working with those populations to come up with, through breeding, a plant that can resist the blight. But when we lost the chestnut, we didn't even know what insects might be dependent on that tree, and we didn't even know what was out there. We don't even know what we lost when we lost that tree. We lost an entire chunk of our food web here, and we never even knew what it was. We make decisions with blinders on about our gardens, about our lives, without really realizing, and this is not a criticism, it's just a fact of human behavior, without really thinking about what the consequences might be on the wider environment. One of the things I share with groups that I speak to is the decisions we make on our gardens have consequences far beyond our fence lines. So as to what we're going to lose, if we continue to bring in indiscriminately exotic plants for agricultural or ornamental purposes, we continue to run the risk of bringing along diseases and pests which will continue to devastate our native plants, such as the anthracnose that devastates our dogwoods, the emerald ash borer, the Dutch elm disease. And we are going to end up, if we extend this to its logical conclusion, we will have a global ecosystem, which will be made up of a specific limited number of species. There will be extremely limited diversity. We will lose huge chunks of our insect life, probably most of our insect life, and huge chunks of every other part of our environment, part of the food web. We don't even know what we're going to lose. We can't even begin to capture, envision it, realize it.
So here in Michigan, Michigan native plants have, why are they better suited, I guess, to this environment and dealing with everything that Michigan weather and the state throws at it?
That's a great question, because a lot of people who grow up or spend the vast portion of their lives here don't realize, it doesn't even occur to them that we live in an environment with extreme weather. We can span 100 degrees Fahrenheit in 12 months here in Michigan, and that is not really the case anywhere else. You know, you don't get that in Florida. You don't get that in California, for sure. We have extreme weather, and the plants that evolved here, even though they may be the same species in other parts of the country, because there's some of these plants have very wide ranges, they are specifically adapted, and they have some genetic distinctions from their cousins from elsewhere. They evolved here. They evolved to accommodate the soil conditions. They evolved to accommodate the climatic conditions. You know, we always have a drought in July and August. And there are plants that really languish in the drought, and a lot of them are exotics. And there are plants that laugh at a drought, like my cup plant, which is 9.5 feet tall when there's a drought and 10 feet when it isn't. One of the reasons I've keep doing more and more with natives is because I don't have to work as hard. And contrary to some people's perception, I actually find the natives much more beautiful because they're so varied. My maintenance in my garden every year is less and less as my natives thrive. I don't use any chemicals whatsoever, either fertilizers, you know, growth enhancers, or pesticides, you know, to suppress weeds or anything. I don't use any chemicals. I use no power tools. And I get to spend more time enjoying my garden and watching the hummingbirds and the butterflies and the goldfinches and hearing the spring peepers.
Well, we're in your big, beautiful garden, so let's take a look at a couple of native plants.
This is cup plant, and you can see it's got a lot of insect larvae, nymphs on there, and I've got a lot of people who are concerned about that. I don't know what they are, but I know that if they're beneficial, I don't care about it. And if they're not beneficial, a beneficial will come along to feed on them. So Mother Nature will keep everything in check. Cup plant is in the Silphium family. It's called Silphium perfoliatum. Perfoliatum refers to the fact that the stems, which are square in section, pierce the paired leaves. And the leaves are always arranged at 90 degrees to the pear below and above them. And the reason for this is that when it rains, the water spills like a big fountain down the plant. And that water that's cupped by the perforated leaves is then there for the larger insects to drink. It also traps younger insects to feed the plant. It also provides water for some of our birds as well. It gets small yellow flowers at the very top of the plant, and you get a lot of nectaring insects on there. You get a lot of birds feeding on the seed. You get squirrels jumping all over it like it's a jungle gym in August to get the seed as well. So this is a plant that really gives up a lot for the wildlife. And it's a plant that can shake off a drought. The roots go down way into the soil. So even if we have a severe drought, as we did in 2012, it just laughs it off.
All right, where to next?
The thing about native plants is you often can find a native equivalent to something that you're already growing in your garden that's an exotic traditional garden plant. For example, you have your oriental poppies. Well, we have what we call a celandine poppy, which is a spring flowering poppy with beautiful yellow flowers. We have one of the more popular summer garden plants is the lily family, our oriental and Asiatic lilies. But we have a lily here in Michigan. It's not just endemic to Michigan. It does live in other parts of the Midwest, but it is called the Michigan lily. And it's a beautiful Turk's cap type lily, brilliant deep orange, and the little stamens look like little ballet shoes hanging down. And it's an absolutely to die for plant. It's a spotlight wherever it grows. It can get up to 6 feet tall if it's happy. It does like wetter conditions. And it is an absolute showstopper. The plants that I have in my garden are actually plants that I inherited when my mother passed away. So aside from their value to me as native plants, they also have a very profound sentimental value, and I treasure them.
Are there any plants that are native to Michigan that people would be surprised are a native plant here?
I would say probably the most surprising plant in my garden that people are always amazed that it's a native plant is the prickly pear cactus. And it is a true cactus. It's a really interesting plant because when fall comes, the pads sort of deflate and they get very sad and they sort of repose on the ground and you pray for snow because it looks like a corpse and you want to cover it up. And then comes spring, it just sort of re-inflates itself. It has these beautiful yellow flowers with orange throats that last, each flower lasts less than a day. And it's really something special, really special.
Yeah, I never would have thought that Michigan has cactuses. That's for sure. So in gardening, there's kind of an entire industry, magazines built off of, as you mentioned, you know, what's new in this philosophy, what's hot, what's coming out. Do you think there needs to be a kind of a paradigm shift in the way people think about gardening?
I think we're going to be seeing a paradigm shift. I know of people who have canceled subscriptions to gardening magazines because they don't carry information on natives. I am seeing more awareness of natives. I do realize that my perspective is rather parochial, you know, informed by my own experiences and my own interests and values. But I think that that is becoming more part of the general consciousness. More people are asking questions and wondering, well, what's the difference? There are a lot of preconceptions about native plants that I fight with. Even when I was working with the Greening of Detroit on their trees committee and we were selecting plants for our tree sale, and I was always the proponent for including some natives, and the response I always got is, well, no one knows what to do with them. And my response to that is, isn't that part of our mission is to educate people about these things? And when you start talking to folks about, well, if you grow common milkweed, you'll get monarch butterflies, and if you grow spice bush, you could get spice bush swallowtail butterfly, and if you grow this plant, you'll get this butterfly. It's really amazing. The eyes light up. People are beginning to realize that the environment has changed. They are seeing fewer butterflies. They are seeing fewer of the big bumblebees. They're seeing fewer blue jays or cardinals. And they're not happy about that. And if we want to repair that damage, or at least stop the trend, if we can't reverse it, at least stop it, native plants are critical to accomplishing that end.
Cheryl English is a master gardener. She lives and gardens in Detroit's East English Village. Cheryl, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
And if you'd like to see photos of Cheryl English's Detroit garden creations and all those native Michigan plants, visit our website, WKAR.org. Click on Current State. This Current State environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment is available at greatlakesecho.org. Every July brings a summer music tradition to the Michigan State University campus. The MSU Summer Carillon series begins tomorrow with evening performances every Wednesday through July 31st. A carillon is an intricate musical instrument that employs a system of bells housed inside a clock tower. The MSU carillon is housed near the top of the iconic Beaumont Tower, which dates back to 1928. Carillons themselves have existed since the 16th century. This month, four Americans, a Belgian and a Dutch musician, will play the MSU carillon as part of the summer series. Current State's Kevin Lavery talked with MSU's resident carillonneur, Ray McClellan, about this ancient instrument.
We are in the ground floor of Beaumont Tower, and we're at the practice clavier, practice keyboard for the carillon. So this is where the students learn to play the carillon.
Describe what this thing looks like, Ray.
So it looks like wooden batons sticking out from an instrument. And you use your hands, closed fists, to play. It's like this. Of course, this is electronic sounds. This is not real bells here on this practice keyboard. And so you're using your hands as well as your feet can play.
Become a carillonneur?
Well, I was studying as an organist. I was doing my doctorate in organ, and I came across one day I heard the carillon playing, and I discovered I could go and see how it was played. I thought, oh, you're using your hands and your feet. I do that when I'm playing the organ. And so then I discovered the instrument that way. I started studying it. As a doctoral student, I was able to use that as a second instrument to support my major.
What's difficult about this instrument that looks like an organ, but also looks like, as you say, a bunch of wooden batons? It looks like nothing that most people have ever seen before.
Well, so when you're playing the carillon upstairs, when you strike these keys, you're not moving the bell, but you're moving the clapper inside the bell. So the biggest bell, again, weighs 2.5 tons, but you're moving the clapper, which is 150 pounds, so that's still quite a bit of weight. So there is a difference in the way the keys feel. And so you have to develop the skill of how you strike the key. And it's a big instrument. So you have to be able to reach distances both ways, with your hands and your feet. But I do have people of all different heights. I have one person who this bench adjusts, and she adjusts the bench all the way down to the bottom because she's short. But that doesn't stop her from playing. And I'm one of the taller people, and so I have the bench adjusted pretty high. Look where we are. You see the clock? So this is the faces of the clock, and these are individual clocks. There's four sides, but they're all individual. But the automatic bells are played by computer here and downstairs.
And again, the largest bell is 2.5 tons. And how many bells in total?
49 bells. And so the biggest bell is 2.5 tons, and the smallest bell is 15 pounds. Let me play the other bell, the big bell. And so it's a big bell. There's more metal, so the sound just keeps going and going and going, whereas the little bell doesn't ring very long.
Did all of MSU just hear that bell?
Yes, yeah, so they're all thinking, oh, it's 1 o'clock, but it says 1:15.
Now, at 1:15, is this thing going to go off like a player piano by itself?
It's going to go off just like Westminster, like Big Ben. Da, 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 da. You'll feel the vibrations. When I play the carillon, these are clappers that move when I play. But when the computer plays, there's big hammers on the outside of the bells. So it's a different action.
So the computer activates the hammers.
Yes. And so the computer obviously does all the quarter hour, half hour, full hour, and it is programmed to play MSU Shadows at 5 o'clock every day. And then seasonally,
and there it is.
Right.
Do you ever get tired of it, or is it always beautiful to you?
Well, I wouldn't sit here all day and listen to the quarter hours to the Westminster Chimes play. But no, I don't get tired. I don't play it. You know, I'm here one day a week. I play Tuesdays at noon, and it's usually open to the public when I play at noon. Other days of the week, some of my students and assistants play. So it's usually played every day at noon during the weekdays. And it's not always open to the public on those other days, though. So it depends on if we have somebody to guard the ground level.
Very nice. Well, shall we do some carillon-ing?
Let's play the carillon.
And again, what you're going to be playing will be heard across campus.
Right. And it's amazing how the wind can blow the sound a long distance. Otherwise, sometimes you can't hear it. So it's amazing how the sound carries in different directions.
So East Lansing is in for an unexpected treat in just a few moments then.
That's right. Here we go.
Très bien, Quasi.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Merci. Ray McClellan, it's been a pleasure to talk with you here in Beaumont Tower and to watch you play this fascinating instrument. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Glad to have you here.
From the top of Beaumont Tower at Michigan State University, I'm Kevin Lavery for Current State.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We'll be adding some new contributors in the coming months to lend their voices on an array of topics. Today we have our first book review from local Lansing writer Scott Southard. He read Let It Burn, the latest in the Alex McKnight crime series written by Steve Hamilton, and offers these thoughts.
I am a book nerd. And what that means is I love to get in debates with fellow readers and writers. These are not the merely did you or did you not like a book discussions. No, these can be deeper, getting into the heart and state of our beloved art form today. And one of the points I like to bring up from time to time is the influence of TV on books. I don't mean how TV executives go to our library and bookshelves to rip away ideas for future series like True Blood, Dexter, and Game of Thrones. This is the other way around, the flip side. How has TV affected how people actually write books? Let me give you an example I have. I'll call it Exhibit A. Let It Burn is the 10th book in the Alex McKnight crime thriller series by Steve Hamilton. And I'll be honest with you, it is the first book in the series I have read. Did I need to read books 1 through 9 to understand this one? No, not from what I can tell. The experience was much like tuning into an old Law & Order episode on TNT. It doesn't matter who is investigating the case and what the crime is. You know the drill in front of you, the beats the story will take. Alex McKnight is an ex-cop from Detroit, now living on disability after a shooting that killed his partner and left him injured. He lives in the UP, but somehow keeps falling into adventures. And in this one, it is a murder investigation from his past, bringing him back to his old haunts and a case that he thought was closed. If there's one thing that Steve Hamilton has done well, it is express the environment and nuances of the culture and backdrop of Detroit in the 80s to the present day. A city under great changes, struggling under the weight of its debt. Alex narrates just like one of those cops from those TV shows, and his dry description of street after street in Michigan captures not only the atmosphere of that bleeding old city, but also of him. He is a man on a set path, because that is what he does, no matter how foolish it might be. Maybe I would understand Alex more, appreciate him more as a character, if I had met him over the previous nine tales. But this case doesn't help his cause, as I can feel the pace and rhythm of how the story will turn before it does. The twist, the second twist, the surprise murderer, and don't get me started on the last line the hero says to the villain. There will be groans echoing throughout the country over that one. If you enjoy crime fiction, or occasionally watch shows like this, there are really no surprises here for you. Of course, for some, that is a place of comfort. Maybe the desirable summer read, and this book coming out at this time is the perfect event. It is not an adventure that will keep you up at night gasping, wondering what will happen next, but it might satisfy that itch for blood on someone else's hands. I think if I was to find one word to sum up the book, it would be bleak. From the dark, meandering cover image of train tracks going off into a foreboding unknown, to the empty streets filled with empty buildings that Alex finds as he travels, seeking his serial killer and the occasional Canadian beer. What disappointed me the most with this book is that I don't believe Steve Hamilton really took advantage of what makes a book different from other storytelling mediums like TV. There is no beauty or uniqueness in his prose, no breathtaking insights into characters that only a novel can deliver. For fans of Steve Hamilton, crime fiction, and Alex McKnight adventures, this book might have been just what they were waiting for. For me, a newbie to this literary franchise, Let It Burn was not enough to draw me in for another episode. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott's the author of two new novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. And you can catch author Steve Hamilton tonight at the Schuller Books in Okemos starting at 7 p.m. He'll be giving a talk and will be signing copies of his new book, Let It Burn. We appreciate hearing what you think of Current State. We'll pass along one recent comment here from Sarah Lauren. Sarah describes herself as a loyal WKAR and PBS supporter. Thank you, Sarah. Sarah takes issue with some of the comments of a guest from last week, Matt Hulbert of the Lansing Area AIDS Network. Matt maintained that efforts to teach young people about HIV/AIDS are quite inadequate in the Lansing area. Sarah writes, I teach fifth grade in the Lansing Public Schools as well as many other districts in Michigan. All those districts are part of the grant-funded Michigan Model for Health Education, a full health curriculum that includes AIDS-HIV prevention. We devote 2 days just to AIDS education with information going home to parents and families. My students know the facts about how AIDS is transmitted. Thank you, Sarah, for your feedback and for listening. Get us your comments at currentstate@wkar.org. Looking at tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment features Advent House Ministries, also a film review of The Lone Ranger. All that and more coming up Wednesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer of Current State. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.